Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. So nice to be back today. The conversation we're going to have today is one that I've long been interested in and just needed to find the right person. Today, Professor Kevin Gaines from UVA's Department of History, where he is the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I should say also that I teach at UVA in the Carter G. Woodson Institute of African American and African Studies.
And important, is that something I missed out on back in the 1980s?
Well, I think it certainly existed in the 1980s. It was a program of research, and they had postdoctoral fellows. In fact, the Woodson Institute is probably world-renowned for the success and productivity of its postdoctoral fellows program. So many great scholars who've written books on African-American history, African-American studies, which, of course, is U.S. history, came out of the Woodson Institute. They spent their formative research period of finishing their books at UVA. So that is, folks in U.S. history, African-American history, know the Woodson Institute for all the great books that were produced here.
Well, so today's show, I've titled it About Civil Rights, Social Justice, the 1960s, and the 2020 presidential race. So we're going to cover a lot of material. But you are the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice. But I don't want to make the assumption that...
Yeah.
Please, for those who don't know, please tell listeners who was Julian Bond and what was his role in the 1960s civil rights movement?
You know, that's my pleasure to talk about Julian Bond. Julian Bond was a civil rights activist. He was one of the founding members of a civil rights organization called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And they were based in the South, and they were the civil rights organization that focused on the voter education and registration of the most marginalized Black people in the Mississippi Delta. And they were really at the forefront of campaigning for voting rights. At that time, in the early 1960s, African Americans were prevented from voting by a state-sanctioned system that stripped African Americans voting rights. Of course, African Americans throughout the South had the right to vote during Reconstruction, but there was a period in the late 19th century in which state by state in the South, in the former Confederacy, African-American voting rights were taken away. So Julian Bond was a well-known civil rights activist. Some of them, people in SNCC like John Lewis, of course, the recently deceased John Lewis, were well-known figures, national figures in the civil rights movement, and Julian Bond was as well. Julian Bond went from his civil rights activism to running for political office, and he was actually elected to the Georgia State Legislature. And I believe he was first elected in 1965. But, there weren't a lot of Black people in the Georgia State Legislature at the time. And in those times, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, including Julian Bond, had opposed the Vietnam War. And so a lot of Bond's would-be fellow state legislators voted to exclude him from being able to take his seat in the legislature to assume his duly elected position. And he was kept out of the state legislature for a few years until the Supreme Court finally, you know, upheld the legal challenge to the action of these state legislators. So Bond served and became a nationally known political figure. He spoke at the Democratic Convention, I believe. It was either 68 or 72. I really should know that. But and then he was, I think his name was sort of thrown into the discussion as a potential vice presidential nominee. This would have been, I think, a bit later. So Julian Bond went on from there to be a prominent civil rights activist. He headed the NAACP for a few years and was a really outspoken voice for civil rights and social justice. I mean, this is really, an appropriate title for Julian Bond. It's a great honor to be the inaugural Julian Bond chair at UVA. Finally, Julian Bond taught at UVA for almost 30 years, and he taught history. He was a member of the history department, and he taught the course, the lecture course on the history of the civil rights movement. So that is Julian Bond's connection to UVA. But of course, he was a world-renowned figure. I was doing some research on Julian Bond. I actually found out that he had made cameo appearances in several Hollywood movies. So that gives you an idea of what a presence he was and how well known and well regarded he was.
And again, our guest today is Professor Kevin Gaines. He is the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice at UVA's Department of History. As we talk today about civil rights and social justice, we'll be talking about the 1960s, and we'll step forward into into 2020 and the presidential race as well. Professor Gaines, the civil rights movement in the 60s, people look back on that and talk about its importance, its impact and significance. I'm sure that it's a whole course of material, but were there specific institutions that changed dramatically because of the civil rights movement?
Well, I mean, the civil rights movement ended this system of legalized racial segregation that existed throughout the South. And that system of Jim Crow segregation had existed for nearly a century. You know, it started being put in place in the 1880s. And so with the major civil rights federal legislative reforms of the 1960s, the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965, that system was pretty much ended. It was a system that prevented African Americans from pursuing opportunities in employment. It prevented, as I said, African Americans from exercising their right to vote, which, you know, had been enshrined in the Constitution with the 15th Amendment of the Constitution. It ended a system of of segregation in public life. Some of our listeners may remember that era with the signs of, you know, saying white and colored, basically telling black people where they could and couldn't go. And, you know, the system of Jim Crow segregation was pervasive throughout society. Every aspect of public life was segregated. Restaurants, department stores, dime stores, schools, cemeteries, obviously workplaces, And, you know, this was an oppressive system. It was upheld by white supremacist terror, racial terror. If people, if black people spoke out and stood up and tried to change the system, they would face a whole range of adverse effects, from economic reprisals, you know, they'd lose their jobs, to outright violence. So this was a system that really defined the United States. The United States was a Jim Crow society, even though the system existed in the South and really was the bane of the existence of many black people, most black people in the South. It was a system that had the sanction of the federal government. The Supreme Court had upheld segregation in public transportation and public schools. There was a major Supreme Court decision in 1896, Plessy v. Ferguson, that basically said that it was constitutional to discriminate against black people, that they had laid down, the court had laid down the principle of separate but equal. So that meant that you could just basically have this separate apartheid society, and the Supreme Court found a way to square that with the Constitution. The Civil Rights Movement attacked first the separate but equal principle with the Brown decision. So the practice of segregation in public schools and even public higher education was invalidated by the Brown decision, which was the product of decades of legal strategizing and cases led by the NAACP. So in 1954, the Brown decision, Brown v. Board of Education, struck down the court's ruling in Plessy that permitted segregation. And so segregation in public schools, at least, with the Brown decision, was now considered unconstitutional. Of course, we know what happened after the Brown decision. The white South mobilized to prevent the desegregation of public schools in a movement, a sort of a counter movement to the civil rights movement called Massive Resistance. And of course, Virginia was the epicenter of the white South's massive resistance movement.
Let me ask a question about, I'm going to sort of take a step to the right here for just a second and bring us to 2020. So we have massive resistance in the 1960s. And as you said, Virginia is the epicenter, but not the only state using massive resistance, I don't believe.
That's very true.
Is the way that states are using the school system in the COVID, I'll say needs is the way they're presented, is that having a similar effect on lower level socioeconomic status African Americans and other non-whites? Do you think that that is similar to massive resistance in any way?
Well, I mean, I think you're asking a question about basically how much change has there been since the 1950s and 1960s? And to answer the question broadly, even though the court required public schools in the South and even school districts in the North to desegregate it, to desegregate, our current public school system, and really as a reflection of our society, is probably more segregated today than was the case in the 1950s and 1960s. And one of the reasons for that is because many whites, even after, you know, school districts finally complied with court-ordered segregation in the South and certainly in the North, many whites just opted out of the public schools. And they tended to be more affluent whites. In the South, whites defied court-ordered desegregation by reappropriating funds that were meant for public schools to set up private schools. And so in places like Virginia and other places, other states, southern states, you had in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the founding of private schools that were known as segregation academies. So it's sort of like affluent whites in the South, in Arkansas, you know, and, you know, other southern states, just kind of picked up their ball and just kind of went home, and they established these all-white segregated private schools. And so that led, that left, and in doing so, it's important to add, a lot of these school districts in, you know, these southern states, basically, they shut down the schools. They closed the public schools. This was done notoriously in Virginia, but also Arkansas. And so for years, African-American children were deprived of education, deprived of public school education. So there were lost years that that followed in the wake of the Brown decision and massive resistance. And when you had desegregation orders in the North and public school systems embarked on school busing programs, et cetera, once again, you have affluent whites who, you know, had been moving to the suburbs to get out of, you know, what were becoming black majority central cities. You have a lot of whites basically moving to private schools, whether they're parochial schools or other private schools. So the racial and economic divides that followed the civil rights movement and really sort of have persisted and have really gotten worse since the civil rights movement really define the quality of education, public education for families and kids now. And obviously, education, public education is funded through property taxes. And so more affluent areas, which have, you know, more whites, are able to fund schools at a much higher level than resource-strapped inner-city neighborhoods. So you have those kinds of socioeconomic inequalities manifesting themselves in the quality of education available to children in the United States. And there's a huge racial and socioeconomic divide in terms of the quality of education. So that, long story short, is that the folks who are suffering from COVID, COVID's impact on public education, tend to be poorer people and people of color, and affluent white families are setting up education pods, and they have the resources to really opt out of the system the way that affluent whites opted out in the late 1950s and 1960s to escape court-ordered desegregation.
Again, our guest today is Professor Kevin Gaines. He's at UVA's Department of History. He also teaches in the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies at UVA. Oh, let's take a break, and we'll be right back. And here we are back. Thanks again for being with us on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. And we always want to thank 97.9 The Wren for giving us a chance. Kevin Gaines with us, professor, UVA's Department of History. As we talk about civil rights and social justice, the 1960s and 2020, Professor Gaines, I want to, I guess, get some comparisons, if we can. Can you give me some comparison between the Black Power movement of the 60s era and the Black Lives Matter happenings of 2020 time period?
Sure. I mean, just for your listeners who may be wondering what the Black Power movement was, the civil rights movement lasted from, you know, the 50s really until arguably the 1970s. But there are different phases in the struggle. And there is the phase in which the goal of the movement was to get federal civil rights legislation passed. And that when that phase was successful in getting the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act on the books, the movement shifted into a new phase. And that was a phase that represented the unfinished business of the movement, which was really the fight for economic justice. So Dr. King led that phase having the Poor People's Campaign and that sort of thing. But, you know, this was a phase that many younger militant activists were leading. And a civil rights activist named Stokely Carmichael coined the term Black Power to really talk about, you know, the importance of Black people exercising power on their own behalf, controlling their communities, getting elected to political offices, really overcoming decades of discrimination and exclusion from the political process. So that was the Black Power phase of the movement. And when Carmichael launched this slogan, Black Power, people were shocked. I mean, I think that a lot of Americans were just not ready for just the very idea of Black Power. But basically, it reflected the movement's demands for political and economic empowerment by Black people. Now that you've made African Americans full citizens and you have made them sort of equal before the laws, but there were still these persistent problems of racial discrimination, of poverty, of discrimination in employment, discrimination in housing, and police brutality in, you know, many northern cities. And so that was the Black Power phase of the movement. And what Black Power did, why it was so shocking and so revolutionary, was the way of talking about racism in public life was very, you know, it tended to most white liberals, even who considered themselves supporters of civil rights, imagined that freedom would lead to a colorblind society where you didn't really talk about race, and that the differences between blacks and whites would just be irrelevant and just not discussed. And what Black Power did was it just broke that kind of that notion of civility where you're just not supposed to talk about race. And not only are you not supposed to discriminate against race, but you're not even supposed to talk about it. You're not supposed to talk about black people as a group with a unique historical experience and really as, a fundamental part of American society. So Black Power disrupted that tendency to expect race relations in the United States to be governed under this ideal of colorblindness. Black Lives Matter did the same thing, but obviously at a different moment, in a different context, with African Americans facing different plights, you know. So both Black Power and Black Lives Matter foregrounded the idea of systemic racism as a threat to black lives. You know, people didn't really say, they talked about black power. And, you know, I guess what's changed since the black power movement is that African Americans had achieved the measure of political power. African Americans were elected to office. And you could say that in 2008, African Americans claimed like the ultimate prize in terms of power. Of course, now, the election of the first black president, Barack Obama, by no means should be confused with black power, you know, because President Obama did not see himself as the president of black people. He bent over backward to avoid being perceived that way. And you know, he wanted to be seen as president of all the people. So, you know, during Obama's second term, you had this spate of killings of black people by, you know, and often unarmed black people by police and vigilantes. And that was the reason that these young activists coined the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Because, you know, when Obama was elected, everybody, you know, liberals, conservatives, even some black people were saying that we were now in a post-racial society. And that assumption of it being a post-racial society carried along with it that assumption that we're not supposed to talk about race, that, you know, that's over as a problem in our history. And so you had a return to this colorblind ideology that, you know, you're not supposed to talk about, you know, the systemic injustice against black people or anti-black racism. Well, Black Lives Matter disrupted that colorblind presumption the way black power did in the 1960s.
Professor Kevin Gaines with us today as we talk about civil rights and social justice in the 1960s compared to 2020. Professor, I got a couple questions from social media before the show today. Here's one from Davi. Says, how does this summer compare to the climate leading up to the 1968 DNC?
Well, I mean, 1968 was an election year, just as 2020 is. But in 1968, a lot of the demonstrations and protests were against the Vietnam War, which was a very unpopular war. Here, the catalyst, the cause, the reason for all of these protests this summer was just this, I think many Americans just finally came around to seeing how intolerable and how egregious the level of state violence, police violence against black people has become. And I think that the protests this summer have been largely peaceful. But in 1968, there had been peaceful demonstrations, massive anti-war demonstrations. For some years leading up to 1968, but there were also protests that were violent, that were and a lot of those protests in cities like Detroit and Newark in 1967, you know, there were basically uprisings, and the cause for these uprisings was incidents of police brutality.
Well, what's the difference between 1968 and now in terms of a few of those things that you're talking about? I mean, I'm sure that there's a large percentage of the public who might vote for one presidential candidate who would say, uprisings? Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you have to understand that black people don't have these uprisings, which basically involved a lot of arson, often in black communities. And you know, this became the basically African-American marginalized poor people striking back against what they consider to be an oppressive system of police brutality. And the problems of police brutality were really at the forefront in northern cities and cities like Los Angeles, and they were chronic problems. And of course, we know that, you know, in Los Angeles after 1968, you had the uprising in L.A., after the police officers who were caught on camera, videotape, beating Rodney King, who was a black motorist that they had stopped, were acquitted. And so, you know, if you think about what happened in L.A. in 1992, African-American, well, the whole world saw what those policemen were doing to Rodney King. And people, and African-Americans said, oh, finally, because white America tended to deny the existence of this problem. I think one of the problems historically in terms of the relationship between blacks and whites in our society is that whites tend to ignore or not to hear or to listen to African Americans' protests about injustice. And so in Los Angeles, you had the videotape, the officers were brought to trial. African Americans basically waited for justice, and when justice didn't come, they took matters into their own hands and, you know, engaged in, you know, sort of violent behavior and resulting in civil unrest. But you have to, I think the tendency of many white Americans is to just look at the violence and forget what caused the violence, which is this really sort of intolerable kind of police state situation and the level of violence and harassment and mistreatment that is really sort of a chronic problem in many of our cities. So, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people are saying whether or not the outcome in this upcoming election is going to echo the outcome of the 1968 election, because the Republican nominee in 1968, Richard Nixon, you know, campaigned on law and order. And, you know, of course, the President Trump and his attorney general are using that same strategy. They're reading out of that same playbook, although Trump, I think, is a little bit more overt and you know, sort of direct in his racist hostility and his inciting of violence. And, you know, Nixon was not the incumbent. President Johnson was the incumbent. So Nixon, I think, succeeded with that law and order strategy, you know, in 1968, with a very sort of polarized electorate. I don't think that Trump is going to succeed with the law and order, you know, sort of strategy, because A, he's the incumbent, and B, you know, he is undermining that message by engaging in, you know, lawlessness and inciting violence and inciting civil disorder. So, you know, it just doesn't make sense that people would support Trump on the basis of law and order when, you know, anyone with eyes can see that he's trying to really destabilize civil order and incite violence. So he's really the president of lawlessness and disorder. But you know, there are people who will, I think, want. Actually, I think there's enough folks in our electorate, and I think these are the people who are the sort of the hardcore supporters of Trump, who really do want lawlessness and disorder, and feel that the Trump administration would be justified in cracking down on that. But that's like, you know, an arsonist basically, you know, becoming the fireman and wanting to receive credit for putting out the fire.
Our guest today, Professor Kevin Gaines, he's the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice, which is what we're talking about today. We've just got a couple quick minutes before our next break. Professor, can you tell me real quick, are there any mirror images between this current 2019-2020 and the 1960s civil rights movement?
Mirror images, that's tough. I mean, I think there are similarities. And I think the big one that comes to mind is that, you know, there were some turning points in the 1960s civil rights movement, and they usually had to do with news footage of incidents of violence against black protesters, and in some instances against white protesters as well. But obviously, the civil rights movement in those days was predominantly a black movement. The people who were in the streets and protesting tended to be, you know, folks, black working class folks from the South, from black churches. And then you had some civil rights organizations that were somewhat integrated, that had white activists in those organizations and in the movement, like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that I mentioned before. And so those turning points were the scenes, the news footage that came out of Selma, for example, where a bunch of peaceful protesters demanding voting rights were basically overrun by Alabama state troopers and clubbed and tear gassed and brutalized. And that footage went over the national airwaves and internationally. And it was followed by this surge of support for voting rights and a massive march from Montgomery to Selma involving 25,000 people and many whites involved. So, just to bring that to the present, the catalyst for this wave of protests was the, you know, sort of the video of the this slow motion strangulation, not slow motion, but this painfully protracted strangulation of George Floyd by a Minneapolis policeman. And I think that and other social media circulated recordings, video recordings of incidents of anti-black violence were the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement in 2013 and 14, and they were the catalyst for this wave of Black Lives Matter protests in 2020.
Again, our guest today, Professor Kevin Gaines, as we talk about civil rights, social justice, the 60s and 2020. Come back and we're going to talk about the presidential race. Hang tight. All right. Thank you for staying with us. I'm having a great time. I hope you are too. Professor Kevin Gaines giving us an hour of his day to be here with us on WREN and the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. A little history, a little current time. We're going to talk about the presidential race and bring the history forward and see what we've learned and how that might work. Professor, I'm curious about after the 2016 election, I'm always curious how polls are reputable. Do you know, do you study this, how polls are reputable nowadays, how they're taken to give accurate numbers?
Well, you know, 2016 was not a good year for the pollsters, because you know, obviously most of the pollsters had Hillary winning the election and had not really sort of considered the possibility that, that Trump could pull an inside straight with the Electoral College, which is obviously what happened. I think that pollsters, this time around, the polls are showing a pretty strong lead, that Biden's actually polling significantly better than Clinton did in 2016. And those polls in which Biden's like 7 to 8 points ahead of Trump in, you know, the nationally, have been pretty consistent. They haven't really budged over the last few months, even with all the protests, even with all the attempts of, you know, the Trump's appeals to law and order and all those things, you know. So there's one pollster who recently basically said that that Biden should win based on what we know now, that these polls and the electorate is pretty much baked in. And, you know, I'd like to think that that's true. But I think that the other big question is that we don't know that this election is going to be a routine election. In fact, it's not a routine election. It's not. We don't know if it's going to be a free and fair election. So I think the polls might be reassuring to some people, but I think we're, you know, with COVID and a very unconventional incumbent, a very unconventional presidential candidate who's running a very strange campaign of trying to undermine the legitimacy of the election, then I think we're in just really uncharted territory.
Well, you also have an issue with the fact that we now have 24-hour-a-day news, and it's only going to take, I mean, it takes almost nothing to change people's thoughts. Whatever the poll says today, and people were talking about, what does the poll say today? He can win today. He should win today. Well, we're talking about, we have a proven candidate, a proven incumbent who has done many unusual things and still has a hefty percentage of followers. You have a challenger whose past history has shown he can stumble on a regular basis, but we don't know what his proven follower percentage is, who will actually get up and go vote.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say that Trump's base may be smaller than, you know, any conventional incumbent or presidential candidate, but they're probably much more energized and enthusiastic than the Democratic base. I think that, obviously Biden is a candidate who I think in the primary period did not inspire enormous confidence, but as things have turned out, he has been able to remain touched by a lot of these attacks that the Trump administration has been sending his way. You know, he's not as vulnerable to those kinds of really sort of scurrilous attacks as Hillary Clinton was. And, you know, there's still time. There's still, maybe a little less than 50 days before the election. So a lot could happen. But, you know, I think that the pollster that I was referring to basically said that there's very few people at this point who are undecided, that, you know, people sort of have seen Trump and they know what he's all about, and they've made their decision. It's kind of hard to imagine that there would be a lot of undecided voters out there, but, you know, I guess there are. But I think that, you know, some of the pollsters are saying that this is one of those elections where people have probably made up their minds.
I wasn't trying to imply that there were undecided voters for who they would vote for as much as there were undecided voters as to whether or not they would make the effort to vote. And that may be how it determines who wins.
Absolutely. Now, that's a really important point. And that has been traditionally the downfall of the Democratic nominee. I think that, in general, Republicans are much more politically committed to seizing power and pursuing their agenda. And Democrats tend to be a little bit less politically focused. And, you know, part of the problem is that the Democrats have been kind of centrist and uninspiring for a long time. But I think I think also those times when Republicans have won without, they've won through the Electoral College without the benefit of the popular vote, you've had third-party candidates running to the left of the Democratic nominee who siphoned off a lot of Democratic votes. That happened in the year 2000, and it happened in 2016 as well. And you know, in 2016, I think as you were alluding to, the voter turnout among Democratic base voters was lower in 2016 than was the case in 2008 and 2012 when Obama won his elections. So that is a concern. That is a concern. I mean, I think that a lot of young people are energized. Obviously, there's a lot riding on this election, the fate of, you know, what's going to happen on the issue of the climate crisis, what's going to happen in terms of the economic recovery with the damage caused by COVID. How are we going to, you know, get on top of the pandemic and get back to some semblance of normal life? You know, there's so much riding on this election. I just can't imagine that people would not be inspired to get involved. And, you know, let's face it, one of the key strategies of the incumbent of Trump is to really sort of drive down turnout by, you know, creating sowing confusion about the process of voting and basically by alleging that the election's rigged. So the problem with that is he might be discouraging his own voters as much as Democratic voters.
All right, Professor, we have Professor Kevin Gaines here, UVA Department of History. Professor, I want to make sure to leave plenty of time, and we have 8 minutes left to split between what happens if President Trump wins and what happens if Joe Biden wins. So let's start with what happens if President Trump wins, and I'll let you know after 4 minutes, just to make sure we can evenly split. So what happens if President Trump wins the election?
Well, I mean, I think Trump has pretty much said, he's told us who he is, and he said what he wants to do. And I think Trump wants to, Trump can't imagine not being president, because he knows that when he leaves office, he's going to be subject to all kinds of criminal prosecutions. So I think he's going to try, if he wins, then he's going to certainly appoint himself as a authoritarian ruler, a strong man. He's going to call for, and you can already see this happening, prosecutions of his political opponents. So there's going to be attacks on the rule of law, attacks on the independent judiciary. The country and all of the branches of government are going to be sort of forced to sort of toe the line. So there will be attacks on the press, which we've already seen, attacks on the rule of law. And if he wins, then Trump will have succeeded in using the sort of the democratic process to undermine and destroy democracy in the United States. If Trump wins, American foreign policy will probably be made by foreign enemies of this country. Trump has pretty much pursued a foreign policy that has attacked the NATO alliance, and that's the main goal of Vladimir Putin of Russia. So I think we'll probably see more policies of that sort. And we've already seen some atrocities and human rights violations under the Trump administration with the policy of the separation of families at the border. And we're also getting reports of forced sterilizations of migrant women in these border facilities. And so I think what you'll see is more of those kinds of punitive policies that are going to really imperil the lives of people that this, the white Christian nationalist regime deems subhuman or expendable. So I think you're going to see an escalation of violence. You think about this the last few years. African Americans have been the canary in the coal mine in terms of warning the country about, unchecked state power and state violence. One of the things that we've discovered with the protests this summer, this past summer, is that these white middle-class folks who grew up thinking that police and law enforcement were their friends are now seeing having experience of law enforcement that is very close to the experience that African Americans have had, for decades, with the attacks on peaceful protesters in Washington, D.C. And, I think that what we would see if Trump won would be kind of an escalation of the use of state power to stifle dissent and stifle protest, if not, criminalize it.
Okay. Can we talk about Mr. Biden now? So what do you see happening if Mr. Biden wins?
Yeah. Okay. Well, if Biden wins, let's face it, if Trump won, we stand a chance of going decades in reverse in terms of social and political rights as a country. If Biden wins, there is the possibility that there will be a bold federal program to address problems, longstanding problems of healthcare, the recent economic catastrophe caused by COVID. I think that Biden's going to have his hands full if he wins. And he's not going to be able to accomplish much if he doesn't get, if the Democrats don't get a majority in the Senate and the House as well. Biden faces a choice of really sort of trying to pass ambitious health care legislation and economic recovery legislation. But the thing that Biden, I think, is going to have to do, and the Democrats, first and foremost, is they need to shore up voting rights. The House passed a resolution, H.R. 1, that is going to make voting easier for the American people rather than, and it's going to sort of respond to the voter suppression that we've seen, as well as the Supreme Court's gutting of the Voting Rights Act. So they want to restore voting rights. They want to make Election Day a national holiday. There are a whole range of measures that are intended to promote democracy. And then Biden's going to have some kind of commission, a review of the executive branch and all of the crimes and improprieties that happened under the Trump administration. And there needs to be a serious look at legislation to prevent some of the things that Trump was able to get away with. So shoring up government ethics, I think, is going to be an important goal of the Biden administration as well. For example, presidential candidate's going to have to release his or her taxes. So those kinds of things, basically reforms that are meant to shore up our democracy are going to be really kind of the priority. We need to, you know, given the fact that Trump still has a substantial following, I'd like to think with all the current revelations that it's closer to 30% than 40%. But I think we're going to have to really try to enact measures that make it more difficult for a rogue president who is able to control, a House of Congress to abuse the systems of checks and balances and to defy all the norms that we previously thought would be sufficient to maintain stability in our political system. So Biden has the opportunity to pass massive legislation on the level of FDR's New Deal. It's going to be very difficult for him to do that. It's going to be very difficult for him to unwind all of the damage and the vitriol and that percentage of the American population that actually craves authoritarian government. But I think Biden is someone, he's a sort of a trusted old hand in American politics, and I think that he's going to get a lot of encouragement, if not pressure, from progressives in his party. If he's elected, I think he understands what needs to be done to address the crisis in democracy as well as the crisis in the economy and public health.
Well, our guest today, Professor Kevin Gaines, UVA Department of History. He's the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice, and he teaches at the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies at the University of Virginia. Professor, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It was a fascinating hour of history from the 60s and carrying me forward to 2020.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
I'm certainly interested in what happens in November, and we'll have you back on to find out whether you are a happy man or an unhappy man, and can share your thoughts on that, and maybe compare some elections forward from then to now as well.
Well, however I'm feeling at that time, I know I won't be alone.
All right. Thank you, sir. Take care.
You too. Thanks so much.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.